Welcome to the first of a five-part series on King Records, produced for September 2016's King Records Celebration in Cincinnati. I'm Lee Hay. During this hour, you'll hear about Bull Moose Jackson, and in the future, there'll be specials on Wynonie Harris, Roy Brown, and two focused on Henry Glover. The first about his career at King, and the second part on his career after King. Music historian Brian Powers begins this special tonight on Bull Moose Jackson with a bit of his history with King Records. You'll also hear from Bull Moose's manager, Carl Greffenset, and his daughter, Margaret Ford, who spoke with Brian Powers. And by the way, her mother was Ida Jackson. And finally, legendary bassist Jimmy Merritt will talk about his days on the bandstand with Bull Moose. So join me for a look at the career of King Records recording artist Bull Moose Jackson.
Hi, this is Brian Powers, and I'm a local music historian. And I'm going to tell you a few things about Bull Moose Jackson, who was a King Records artist. His real name was Benjamin Clarence Jackson. He was born in Cleveland, Ohio in 1919, and he had an early interest in music. He sang in his church, and by the time he was 6 years old, he was playing the violin. He went to Central High School, and that's where he learned how to play the saxophone. He eventually was playing local gigs, and then he moved to Buffalo and had a lot of success there. And eventually, Lucky Millinder, who was a big band leader, saw him and asked him to join his band in 1944 as a saxophone player. Apparently, according to legend, one of the singers they had for Lucky Millinder's band was Wynonie Harris, and they were playing down in Lubbock, Texas, I think in 1945. And Wynonie Harris was a guy who did what he wanted, and I guess he didn't feel like singing that night and didn't show up. So I guess that by then they knew that Bull Moose Jackson was a pretty good singer, so Bull Moose Jackson stepped in. So he went from being the saxophone player to the lead singer for the band. And so in August of 1945, Sid Nathan here in Cincinnati decided he was going to start the Queen Records label, which was going to concentrate on black music, which was called race music at that time. So in August of 1945, he went to the Cotton Club to try to convince Lucky Millinder to do some recording for him for his new label. But Lucky had a record contract with Decca, so he legally couldn't do that. But he recommended his saxophone player, who also was a singer, to maybe cut a few songs. And that's what they did. They recorded four songs here in Cincinnati, August of 1945. And one of those was a song called Bull Moose Jackson Blues. Now, Bull Moose Jackson, he had the very first R&B hit for King Records, and that was actually for the Queen record label. And that was in 1946. And it was a song called I Know Who Threw the Whiskey Down the Well, which was one of these answer songs for a Lucky Millinder song called Who Threw the Whiskey Down the Well. And that was the very first R&B hit for King Records in 1946, and it was by Bull Moose Jackson. And I believe it was written by Bull Moose Jackson. Now, it was 1948 that was the big year for Bull Moose Jackson. That was his breakout year. That's where he became a star. He left Lucky Millinder's band and started his own band, the Buffalo Bearcats, and he had, he probably had like five or six hits in 1948, 49. The one that really made him really famous or big star was a song called I Love You, Yes I Do, which went to the top 10 on the R&B chart, but it also hit the pop charts, which means that white people were buying that record too. Bull Moose Jackson was a pretty unique guy, especially at King Records, because he had the ability to croon, much like Bing Crosby or Nat King Cole, but he could sing risque songs. And so another song that he had recorded at the same time, I Want a Bow-Legged Woman, which of course was not played on the radio at that time in 1948, but was a big jukebox hit.
Well, I was trying to be able to do both sides of the fence, do ballads, do blues, do jump tunes. You know, I didn't want to be classified strictly a ballad singer or a blues singer or shallow, whatever you want to call it. But I've been very fortunate that I can go on either side. You know, if you want to see a nice, sweet ballad, I can do that for you. If you want to hear a little rock and roll or a little risky, I can do all that.
So that's what Bull Moose Jackson's formula was at King Records in the late 40s. He would do these kind of crooning love songs, and then he would do songs called like Sneaky Pete and I Want a Bow-Legged Woman. And then another interesting thing about Bull Moose Jackson is that he was King's first crossover artist. In 1949, he recorded a song called Why Don't You Haul Off and Love Me, which was actually a hit for another King Records artist, but a country artist. And Bulmers Jackson did a R&B version of it. And it was also a big hit for him in 1949. And that was the first recording. King started doing that a lot. And the first guy to do it was Bulmers Jackson. So he was a very important artist for King Records because he was their first R&B artist. And he was the first really big, cranking out a lot of big R&B hits back in 1948 and 49. And into the early 50s, it started drifting off a little bit there, but he continued to have a few hits, and probably his most famous song that people know, and that's thanks to Aerosmith, is a song called Big 10 Inch, which he recorded with the Tiny Bradshaw Band. And that was, again, something you wouldn't hear on the radio, but something that was a big hit on jukeboxes. He continued to record for King up until about 1953. And then he did record for a few other labels, but eventually I think he got out of the business for a while until he was rediscovered much later, like in the 80s.
It was a lovely Sunday morning, and everyone was gay. Everyone but Deacon Jones, who did not feel that way. He was loaded down with pills. He was plastered to the gills. You could tell it, you could smell it. Every time you heard him yell, I found out who threw the whiskey in the well.
In the well.
Yes, I know who threw the whiskey in the well.
In the well.
Yes, I'm squealing on my friend, 'cause he went south with my inn. Yes, I know who threw the whiskey in the well.
In the well. Deacon Jones, who threw the whiskey in the well.
Just wait and see.
Deacon Jones, who threw the whiskey in the well.
It wasn't me, I will tell you in a minute, soon as I find out what's in it. Yes, I know who threw the whiskey in the well.
This is Carl Greffenstedt from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I had the pleasure to work and record with Bulmers Jackson in the mid-1980s. It was a great experience for two reasons. First of all, I got a chance to meet a true rhythm and blues legend. And second, we were able to give Bulmers one more time in the spotlight toward the end of his life. He had the joy of meeting and performing for hundreds of both old and brand new fans. With regard to the Flashcats, I put the band together in 1979, and I've often joked it was specifically to play Midnight Hour by Wilson Pickett, and that wasn't far from the truth. We were a bunch of white guys and a girl from the suburbs, but we had a fascination for Motown and Stax recordings. So I put together a band with horns to play Midnight Hour. Back in the 1980s, there were bars and nightclubs everywhere, with crowds of baby boomers to fill them. The Flashcats had a wild, lively, and funny show, so we worked nearly every night. By 1982, we started to look further back in musical history, and we added 60 Minute Man and Have Mercy, Baby by the Dominoes. One day, one of our fans came to a show and said that her parents had some old 78s with some great songs on them. She brought Lovin' Machine by Wynonie Harris and Nosy Joe by Bulmers Jackson. We loved the songs immediately and added both of them to our set. Shortly afterwards, we recorded Nosy Joe as the flip side to one of our 45s, Appetite for Love. It wasn't long before we also discovered Big 10-inch record, started doing that regularly, and we would introduce the song as, "Here's a song by Bulmers Jackson," because we just loved that name. In October of 1983, at a club in Heidelberg, Pennsylvania, a Pittsburgh rhythm and blues DJ named Bumblebee Slim, his real name Howard Cozy, came up to me after the show and commented he was surprised to hear someone do Big 10-inch record and that Bulmers was actually still alive. He said he was working in the cafeteria at Howard University. The next day, back in my office, I owned a vintage guitar store, Pittsburgh Guitars, and a small record label, Bogus Records. I started asking people where Howard University was. Looking back, I don't know how we found information before the internet. But somehow I found out that Howard University was in Washington, D.C. So I called the school. I asked for the cafeteria, I asked for Benjamin Jackson, and there he was. I explained that we were a working band in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and we would love it if he would come to town and do a set with us. To prove our legitimacy, I mailed him some of our records, a Flashcat t-shirt, some Flashcat bubblegum cards, even one of our Flashcat record players, because we had a lot of promo stuff in those days. I think he was suitably amused, and he agreed to come. We set a date for November 25th, 1983, and I sent him a plane ticket. The day of the show, I went to the airport to pick him up. I was waiting at the gate, which you could do back in those days, and the entire plane emptied with no sign of Bull Moose Jackson. I was worried for a minute, and then a stewardess came wheeling him out of the plane in a wheelchair. He could walk perfectly fine, but he preferred to be wheeled in a wheelchair by a stewardess whenever in an airport. We took him straight to the Cub to rehearse the show. We picked all of the songs from the two Swedish albums by Jonas Bernholm on Route 66 Records. We did I Knew Who Threw the Whiskey in the Well, Big Fat Mamas Are Back in Style, I Want a Bow-Legged Woman, Sneaky Pete, Nosy Joe, Miss Lucy, Oh John, and of course, Big 10-inch Record. He wasn't sure of many of the lyrics, so we wrote those out in black magic marker on 24 by 16-inch poster boards. We had bought matching music stands for the whole band for the show, so the lyrics fit perfectly well on there. That night, we not only had our regular fans, but hundreds of R&B fans. It was a fabulous night. We did our usual set and then brought him on. He didn't play saxophone anymore since he didn't have any teeth, but he still had a great voice and a wonderful onstage charisma that everyone loved. That first show with Bull Moose, November 25th, 1983, was so much fun that the next morning before Moose's return flight to Washington, we went into the studio and recorded two songs. The first was written overnight by Flash Cat guitarist Dave Kent and was based on a comment that Moose made during the show, "Get off the table, Mabel, the $2 is for the beer." The second song, "I've Got a Gal Who Lives Up on a Hill," was a typical blues shuffle that we ad-libbed in the studio. Moose wrote the lyrics on the spot. Since Bull Moose had no songwriting credits from his entire previous career, Dave Kent listed him as co-writer on Mabel, and we listed Bull Moose as a sole writer on I've Got a Gal. Get Off the Table, Mabel, the $2 is for the Beer was officially released on Bogus Records on May 27, 1984, at Bull Moose's second appearance in Pittsburgh, a gala afternoon concert and picnic at Pittsburgh South Park. The record was soon picked up by Pittsburgh's leading rock and roll station, WDVE, and they played it regularly right between Aerosmith and Twisted Sister and all of the other hard rock songs of the day. It truly stood out, and by fall, Moose was famous in Pittsburgh. Billboard magazine mentioned Mabel in October of 1984, and favorable reviews and orders started coming in from around the world. Based on the success of Mabel, we started to work on a full-length album in the winter of 1984. The LP, entitled Moose Mania, was a collection of new and old tunes. 7 of the 11 songs were originals written by members of the Flash Cats, and once again, guitarist Dave Kent listed Moose as co-writer on the songs that he contributed. The other 4 songs were older tunes. Oh John and Miss Lucy were newly recorded in the studio, and Big Fat Mamas and Big 10-inch Record were live tracks from Bull Moose's October 84 appearance in Pittsburgh. Since the Flash Cats had been performing nightly and doing R&B songs for years, I think we had a good feel for the type of music that would work well with Bull Moose, and he seemed to really like the songs. We had a great time in the studio, it was lots of fun, and he really enjoyed himself. In October of 1984, Michael Jackson was supposed to come to Pittsburgh's Three Rivers Stadium with his Victory Tour, but the show was canceled because of a conflict between Michael and the people selling his T-shirts. We decided to offer an alternative to the Victory Tour with the Bull Moose Jackson Victrola Tour that same weekend. It was at a club called the Liberty, and the owner let us paint the entire front of the club to look like Three Rivers Stadium. At that point, Bull Moose's 45, Get Off the Table, Mabel, was a big hit around Pittsburgh, so we not only drew all of Moose's older fans, but an entire new generation of fans. It was 2 nights of sold-out crowds. But I'll never forget seeing Moose standing by the stage door with a long line of teenagers in front of him getting his autograph. It really warmed my heart to see him bonding not only with his generation, but with a newer generation of fans. So 1985 was our busiest year with Bull Moose. We released a new album, Moose Mania, and again got great reviews and great sales from around the world. Moose wasn't really interested in hitting the road in a vehicle, so we stuck to cities that we could fly to. There were several gigs around Los Angeles, several trips to New York City, as well as a few appearances around Pittsburgh. In fact, the mayor of Pittsburgh declared June 13, 1985 as Bull Moose Jackson Day in Allegheny County. Another thing I'll never forget is when we were in Los Angeles and we had a chance to visit Joe Turner's house. Joe was in bed most of the time at that point because his health was failing, but he still had a brand new Cadillac in the driveway, one of those ones with the raised spare tire on the back hood and fake straps holding everything together and gold everywhere. He said he bought it with Blues Brothers money. Moose sat right by his bed and they talked about the old days for an hour. And it was just so nice to see. It was also nice that Joe actually came out to see us perform the following evening when we were in Los Angeles. On June 29th of 85, Moose appeared at New York's Carnegie Hall. And in July, he toured Europe with the Johnny Otis Show. When we were in New York City rehearsing for the Carnegie Hall show, we did a rehearsal in the afternoon and then had a few hours to kill before the evening show. So Moose suggested that we drive up to the Apollo. Now, this is 1985 in Harlem, and needless to say, I was a little bit hesitant to do that. But Moose said, oh, you'll be okay. You're with me. So we got a cab. We drove up to Harlem, and we pull over across the street from the Apollo Theater. As we're getting out of the cab, sitting there on the sidewalk, leaning against the building, was an elderly gentleman. And he looked up, and the first thing he said was, Bull Moose Jackson, I haven't seen you in 30 years. So I knew I was going to be safe as long as I was with Moose. In November of 85, he even did a national radio commercial for RC Cola. And then we ended 85 with a show in Washington, D.C. By early 1986, his health had started to fail. We didn't know it at the time, but it was cancer. And his main method of dealing with it was vodka. On April 19th, 1986, to celebrate his birthday, we did a big show in Pittsburgh and flew former Lucky Millinder singer Anastine Allen in from New York. It was a great show. That fall, we did two more shows in New York City, but at that point, he was self-medicating heavily. By early 1987, he entered the hospital to begin treatments, and we only made a few appearances in late 1987, including a Halloween show where he appeared as Jimi Hendrix, complete with wig, and the Merry Christmas show. Thanks to all the publicity of Moose's return to showbiz, we got a lot of fan mail. One of the letters was from an old girlfriend, Evelyn Simpson, in Cleveland. She and Moose renewed their friendship, and in 1988, he moved to Cleveland to be with her. We only did one show in 1988, a 69th birthday party for Moose at a club called Graffiti in Pittsburgh. We tried to arrange for some events in late 88 and early 89, but his health was not up to it. He passed away in Cleveland on July 31st, 1989, with Evelyn by his side. Evelyn was at a loss as to what to do, so I arranged for a funeral home and a cremation in Cleveland. Before that could happen, though, I got a call from Paulette Jackson Jarrow, one of his daughters, and she insisted that he be brought to Washington, D.C. for the funeral and burial. I attended his funeral in Washington and met some of his family members for the first time. I did not stay for the burial, but I believe he is buried somewhere near Washington, D.C. I don't know how close Moose was with his family members, and all of the time I worked with him, he rarely mentioned them. But his daughter, Paulette, was very friendly with me at the service. Sadly, she passed away a month and a half later. The late 1940s and early 1950s rhythm and blues music is important because it bridges the gap between the big bands of the early 1940s and rock and roll in the 1950s. And with 9 hit records during that time, Bull Moose helped establish rhythm and blues as a commercially viable musical form. And his songs were such lively, good-natured, toe-tapping fun that they still draw people to the field of rhythm and blues today. I believe that years and years from now, when musical historians chronicle 20th century rhythm and blues music, Bull Moose Jackson's name will be mentioned, and his recording of what may be the consummate R&B song, Big 10-inch Record, will be played. So what a great legacy for Bull Moose, or any artist, that through the success of your songs, you bring new fans to your field of music.
God be the strangest woman. Believe me, this chick's no cinch. But I really get her going when I take out my big 10-inch record of the band that plays the blues. The band that plays the blues. She just loves my big 10-inch record of her favorite blues. please her. I gave her a little pinch, but she said, now stop that jiving and get out that big 10-inch record of the band that played the blues. Well, the band that played the blues. She just loves my big 10-inch record of her favorite blues. I cover her with kisses when we're in a lover's clinch. And when she gets all excited, she begs for my big 10-inch record of the band that plays the blues. Well, the band that plays the blues. She just loves that big 10-inch record of her favorite blues.
My name is Margaret Lucille Jackson Fort. Bull Moose Jackson was my father. I'm his oldest daughter.
Can you tell me a little bit about Bull Moose Jackson, your father? Where was he born, where he grew up?
He was born in Cleveland, Ohio, and he grew up in Cleveland, Ohio.
Did he have siblings? Any stories about when he grew up in Cleveland that you've heard?
Not very much. I don't know anything about a sibling, no siblings. From my understanding, he was the only child, but I think, you know, you looked it up and found out later that he had a sister, and I never knew anything about her.
So can you tell me a little bit about how your parents met?
All I know is one of my friend's mothers, who was a good friend of my mother, told me that my mother was out at a nightclub, and he was playing there, and he got attracted to her, and he came over and, you know, started talking. And my mother's friend say, "You gonna talk to him?" You know, "Oh, he likes you," you know, the regular girl thing. And they met at a club.
Did they meet in New York?
New York City.
Now, your mom, where was she from?
She was from Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
And what brought her to New York City?
Well, she was in the service. She was in the WAC. When she got out the WAC, she went to New York to work.
Do you know that around the time that your parents would have met?
Well, I was born in 1946. I'm going to give them a couple of years before I was born.
So when you were growing up, I know your parents eventually got divorced at a certain time, but you lived with both your parents in New York. Can you talk about where you lived in New York and what memories you have of that?
I lived with my mother and my father, and I can remember of us living on 8th Avenue. I have a picture of my grandmother and my uncle holding us, and they told me that was in front of the place where we lived at. But I do remember an apartment that we lived in on 8th Avenue, and it was with my father and my mother. I was very young. I still have a vivid remembrance of the apartment, how it looked, where my bedroom was, where my dad's bedroom was, my mom and dad's room was, you know.
What part of New York were you guys living in?
Harlem.
Can you give us some memories of living in Harlem?
Yeah. Well, I remember one time, in the apartment, I can remember us, my sister and I, playing in the bedroom. When you walk in, the kitchen was to the left, the bedroom was to the right, and you walk directly into the living room. And they had pocket doors, and on the left side of the bedroom of my mom and dad was my sister and I's bedroom, and just normal children that like to play and everything.
Do you have much memories of your dad with music? Did you ever remember him playing music around the apartment or him singing or anything like that?
Yes, I remember him with the music. He used to practice on the saxophone, and quite naturally, we got on his nerves. He would tell us we have to go downstairs because he's trying to practice. And he used to take us to some of his performance also. I remember he took us to the Apollo when he played at the Apollo. We traveled with him a little bit, you know, with him and my mom and my sister. I remember some of that because my dad loved station wagons. And I remember him having a station wagon because everything could fit in the station wagon. We all would be together.
Do you have much memories of when he played at the Harlem or some other show, what he was like on stage?
I can remember him at the Apollo. That's the only place I can remember him playing that. My sister and I was there because we were backstage, and he sang. He had a beautiful voice. What's good about my father was his speaking voice and his singing voice was the same. You know, like some people speak and they sound different from the singing voice, but his was identical. That's why sometimes when I hear his music, it kind of brings tears to my eyes because It just sound like he's talking because he sound the same way when he talked, the same way.
Now, at some point, your parents got divorced and you were living with your mom in New York. Did you keep much in touch with your dad?
Yes. He used to keep in touch with us and mom used to keep in touch with him, you know. And oh, wow, we always wanted to see our daddy all the time. And I can't remember one time. We were, must have been about 9 and 10 or 8 and 9. And my mother sent us to him without his knowledge. And he was living in Philadelphia. And my sister and I stayed in the hallway for a minute before we could knock on the door. And when we did knock, we were running hide. And he come out and look. And we looking at him. And then we finally knocked on the door and stood there. And when he came to the door, he said, "Yes, can I help you?" My sister and I said, "Mama sent us here." And he said, "Come in." And then he got on the phone and, you know, they went to talking. So he kept us about a week and he took us around different places. He had a little chihuahua, I like dogs. And we went to the show. He had a show in Philly somewhere. And we went to one of his shows there. And that's about it. We, like I say, we stayed about a week and then we had to go home because he was going out of town and he couldn't take us with him.
As you grew older, you were living with your mom and then you had some tragedy with your mother and you ended up in Louisiana.
What happened, my mother passed, you know, well, she passed very tragic. It was something that happened. And see, my mama had a list. And she had everybody's name on the list. She said, "If anything happened to me or whatever, whatever, call these people." And that's what I did. And when I called everybody, nobody didn't know anything. And the police came and got me from school. And they told me my mom was dead. They found her body on the roof. Someone had killed her. And we had to go to the police station. And when we went there, they called my dad. He came to the police station and he came and picked us up and took us to my uncle's house, who was my mother's brother. And that's who we stayed with because my daddy was still traveling. And he did all the arrangements and everything. He had a funeral. I don't remember where it was. We weren't allowed to leave New York. We had to stay in Baton Rouge. But they did, you know, let us go to the funeral home. But we were living with my uncle until school was out. Then we had to go to Louisiana.
And that's where I guess you kind of lost a little bit in touch with your dad.
But yeah.
But then you have a story about how you reconnected with him. Can you tell us that story?
Yes. And, you know, I was working in the hospital and I was looking through the Life magazine and I saw a picture of a man playing a saxophone. And as I read down at the bottom, it said Bull Moose Jackson playing at Jimmy Carter's inauguration. I got very, very excited. I still have that picture out of that magazine. And I went to show it. Everybody on my unit told them that was my daddy. And I'm like, "That's not your daddy." I said, "Well, yes, it is, too." One night, a friend of mine called me, and she said, Margie, she said, "Go to the store, get a newspaper." She said, "There's an article in there about your father." I said, "What?" I ran out the house and I drove, took my car, went to the store, got the newspaper. And when I read the article and I read down where it came from, Washington, D.C., and I called 411 and he was listed. He answered the phone and I started talking to him. And I said, "You don't know who you're talking to, do you?" He said, "No." I said, "This is Margie." He went to hollering. Oh, he was so elated and so glad to hear from me. It had been 15 years that him and I and my sister had set eyes on each other, that he had heard from us, you know, and he came down to visit us. And when he did come down, he gonna take the bus. And he fell off the bus and broke his leg in Mississippi. And we had to rent a U-Haul to go to Mississippi to get my dad out of Pascagoula, Mississippi, and bring him to Baton Rouge. And he stayed with me until he was able to travel. And once he, you know, he was able to travel, he went back to Washington. But he did come back again. He came back twice.
Well, you found him living in Washington, D.C. What was he doing in Washington, D.C. at that time?
Oh, he was working. He was with Carl. He had a band called the Flash Cat.
Now, wasn't he also working at Howard University?
Yes. he started working there, I think in between music with Carl. I think he was doing music and working there because I got pictures of him working. I think he was doing catering work at Howard University.
You know, I've seen pictures of Boomless Jackson, but I was wondering, what was he like when you knew him, you know, as a father and stuff? But what was his demeanor? How would you describe him to someone who's never met him or anything?
Well, like I said, it had been 15 years. And after, you know, we got together after 15 years, he seemed to be a very, very nice person. And he was good to me. I just hated that he had to leave. I wanted him to stay with me. And no, he had to go back. He said he got to go play music and he had to go to work and whatever, you know. And that was the second time. Because the first time he came, he said he was coming back and he did come back. And it was a surprise. He surprised me because what he did, instead of letting me know he was coming, he called me and told me he was at the airport. I say, what? And when he told me the airport, he didn't say, what airport? So we go all the way to New Orleans. He was in Baton Rouge. That was so funny, you know, but he was right here. But I really, really wanted him to stay with me.
I know he had sort of a comeback with the Flash Cats. How aware of you was it of him having this comeback and him touring, you know, later in his life?
Well, I really didn't know anything about it until after the accident. I met Carl. He told me Carl was his manager. I talked to him on the phone. And the second time he came down here to visit me, that's how I found out about it. Other than that, I really didn't know.
So he got ill near the end of his life. Can you talk about how you heard about that?
Well, from what I read on the Cleveland Blues Society, they had done something for him when he, you know, got ill, and they gave him a party, end of his career party. But when I found out that he was ill, the lady who he went to live with in Cleveland, she called me, and she told me that my dad was with her. They both did, because I talked to him, too. And she said that she don't know why he come there, because she was in a wheelchair and on oxygen. I said, well, he didn't have to come stay with you, because he could have came very well and stayed here with me, because I had four bedrooms. He could have lived with me, you know. But he told me he didn't want to bother me and all of this. And he did send me some information about him, some papers, 45 record, and he sent me and my sister a birthday card. But when he got very ill, I didn't know. The next thing I heard from that lady that my daddy had passed. And I say, passed where? She say he died. And I was extremely upset because nobody let me know that he was that ill. Because if I would have known my dad was that ill, I would have came up there to see him. I would have tried to get him moved down here to Louisiana, but I didn't know.
And you were able to make it to his funeral in D.C., right?
Right. My sister and I both. When she told us about my dad had died, I don't know how we got in touch with the wife that he had that we didn't know anything about, and the brother that we were supposed to have had that we didn't know anything about. Oh, I know what it was. My sister was living in Washington, D.C., and she found out a lot of information on my father. And that's how we got to meet our brother. That's how we got to meet his wife. So when everything was going on, we went up there. My sister was already there. When I said we, I had to bring a couple of my children. And we stayed in Virginia. And then we traveled from Virginia to D.C. And the funeral service was at Howard University. And we met her. I have a lot of pictures of the funeral service. The night before the funeral, I got a picture of myself and Carl and my sister and the viewing of the body and everything. I have a lot of pictures like that.
One of the things that recently happened, recent years, is your father was honored in Cleveland, Ohio, and you went up to Cleveland. Can you talk about what the occasion was, what they were doing in Cleveland?
What happened was I went to the Cleveland Blues Society. I can't remember how that came about. And I put in my name and everything and told them who I was related to and who I was. And I got a call from the vice president of the Cleveland Blues Society telling me things about my father. And they had a big old write-up of him back in 2009. And he told me that they had an award for him, but they didn't know who to give it to. and that he didn't know that he had children. And he asked me, would I come up and accept the award from 2009? I said, sure, because they had a boat ride, and that was the first annual boat ride when I was invited to come up there. And that's how I got to go to Cleveland.
When you hear your dad sing, what do you think about?
I get sad. I get a little bit of both, a little bit of sadness and happy just to hear his voice, his music. And I found out about a little movie he did with Moms Mabley called Boarding House Blues. And I found it on YouTube, and I watched it on my computer. It was so funny. I still listen to his music. I got one in my radio right now. It wakes me up every morning.
Well, do you know whatever happened to his saxophone or anything?
No. I could tell you this. When my father came the first time, he brought a lot of things with him. And he left them with me. And when he came back the second time, he told me he had to take it back because that lady, whoever she was, wanted him to get his stuff from me or something like that. I was very upset about it. But I really do believe that she have it, or somebody in the family, and her family have it. I don't know if she's still living or not. I don't even know her name, you know, but I can tell you this. I was visiting my grandmother one time, my sister and I, and we were playing in a park in Cleveland. And the little girl we were playing with, and we was talking about our daddy. We said, we up here visiting our father. And the little girl said, well, what's your daddy's name? And we told him. And she said, that's my daddy. And she went and told her mother and the mom. I never did get to talk to her, but she looked out the door, and I saw the lady. And, you know, I forgot my brother. I had a brother. My little brother was living with my father's mother and father. But he had an accident, I think, at the age of 13. He was swimming somewhere, and he drowned. He was named after my father. His name was Benjamin Clarence Jackson also. And I did meet his mother. This little girl told me that was her father, too. I never seen her no more, never heard nothing else about her. But as for the little boy, I met him, and, you know, we all stayed in the same house at one time when my sister and I went to visit my grandmother. I have pictures of that also.
Was there anybody in your family that has inherited the music gene?
For singing, no. Not that I know of. As far as the music, yes, me. I love music, and I love any kind of music and dance. I love, I'm 70 years old, and I love to dance, and I love to have a good time. I like going out. And when it came down to music and dancing and whatever, it was Paulette and I. That was my sister named Paulette. We used to go to the parties and turn them out. They used to love for them girls from New York City to come to the party.
What'd you do with that award that the Cleveland Blues Society gave you on behalf of your dad?
I brought it home. It's in my living room. No, not my living room. That's my sound room. I don't have no TV in there. All I do is music, and I got my daddy's album covers on the wall, and I took that award and put it in the room. I got a mirror that has shelves on it. That's where it is, sitting right there. And I gave that room to my daddy. That's my daddy's room with all the albums and everything. His pictures are all over everywhere. It's the music room. That's what I call it, the music room.
My name is Boo Boo Jackson. And I've really got the blues. My name is Boo Boo Jackson. And I've really got the blues. Got the blues. I ain't got no money. And I ain't got no gal to lose. I've got a home in Alabama. Got a home in Tennessee, got a cabin down in Georgia, but they ain't no good to me, cause I ain't got a dime, and I'm about to lose my mind. I can't travel far, living on a candy bar. My name is Boo Boo Jackson, and I really got the blues.
Jimmy Merritt from Philadelphia, and I went to play with Boo Boo Jackson. in 1950. I got a call from a person by the name of Snooky Hubbard, who was the band manager, and asked me to come on board, and it would be opening in Wilson, I think it was South Carolina. And I went down there, and we opened in the back of a trailer truck on a large lot in extremely cold weather. I never played with them before, but this is my first gig on the road. But everybody seemed to be satisfied with the way things started out, so I went on tour with them. I don't know how long we were out, maybe a couple of months. And during that time, I got to know a band member. From Philadelphia. Benny Golson was just starting his career then. Johnny Coles and myself and Billy Joe Jones. And who already knew the musical director, Ted Dameron. So Bill Moose, who turned out to be a very interesting person to work for. He was a balladeer. He sang the songs of the time, and he was probably second only to Nat Cole and a few others. In his presentation, he sung in a very soft voice, and people were really attracted to his singing, both black and white audiences, because people came from all over to hear him. And he also brought with him my specialty. He had for years worked with Lucky Millinder. And Lucky Millinder had a featured singer with the band, but he always brought Bull Moose out to do specialty songs. And I was surprised when we went on the road. He continued to do these songs. People found him very humorous. I remember one in particular called Bow-Legged Woman. And he did things like that, sort of humorous type of songs, along with the ballads that he became famous for.
So all those guys that you named in the band, they all became pretty well-known jazz guys, but you guys are like kind of an R&B band. I mean, was that unusual? How common was jazz guys doing R&B gigs?
It wasn't particularly uncommon, but it was uncommon that I think it was because of Ted Dameron, that he sought out the highest level of players that could play together. And he was a ruthless taskmaster. So he exacted a lot from the band. Ted did in his function as a musical director. So the band was very consistent. It wasn't like, now we'll do this and that. Now, everything was presented in a jazz mode. Everything was the solos, the pieces. We would go from instrumental to jazz and in and out, because Boomus also played tenor saxophone, and he loved to play as well as sing. So the band was always playing on a level. It was never like a drop in the level, going from like R&B or anything. Even the arrangements that were brought on board by the, the record companies who had their writers, when Tad finished with them, everything sounded the same in terms of the level of the music. Was always, he would seek out everything and had a way of integrating it into the rest of the music in the band.
Well, I was wondering, with the Boomers Jackson band that you were with, what kind of venues were you playing at?
Well, like I was saying, we opened with the band in the back of a trailer truck, Wilson, South Carolina. And that wasn't unusual for those times. You'd go to these little towns, they would have flyers out, people would know a band was coming to town. and we wind up playing on some trailer truck or the back of some farm vehicle out in the middle of a field or in some huge garage, or with possibly only heat being a vial of kerosene or petroleum that might be burning. But the people would assemble, they would hear about it, and they would come out, and then we'd play about 3 or 4 hours, and then everything would be gone, and we'd go to the nearest town where we could get lodging. And that would happen a lot. And then you would go, when you got to larger cities where they had theaters, and we would play the circuit. We would play Washington, D.C., going to the Royal Theater, and we would play there, and then we might go into the Apollo in New York, and the Uptown in Philadelphia, or the Euro Theater at the time.
And how were you traveling around?
Well, we would travel in vehicles, usually. Station wagons and large sedans, and that seemed to work. I mean, I know in some cases there were trailers, but that was a little dangerous. But we never had an accident of a head-on nature or something like that.
Would Boomers Jackson, would he also play sax?
Oh, yes. Yes, we had three saxophones. Snooky played alto, and the two tenors was Boomers and Betty Golson, and Johnny Coles on trumpet, and the rhythm section, Tad Diamond, Perigio, and myself. So it was a pretty full complement. We did one tune that sort of scathed the downbeat, I guess, to make an impression on somebody. That was pretty much a standard with the listeners of the music. It's called, I can't, it evades me at the moment, but it was a great tune. We did it for King Records, and it was Boomers on vocal, and it reached the charts, became a, you know, considered worthy of being called of jazz. But we played what we played, which was always the same. I mean, it was always jazz as far as I'm concerned.
When you played a show, how long was the night? Did you have opening bands? Was it just you guys? How would a typical Boomers Jackson show be?
Typically, we would play alone. It would be a venue in which only Boomers was featured. People would know it was him, and, you know, except when we went in theaters. And then we'd probably be booked with other acts and other headliners, you know. And sometime we had to play for them. For instance, it might be Nina Simone. It might be any headliner of the time.
Did you guys ever play on the same bill with Whiney Harris?
We might have, yes. Yes, I remember him distinctly. I remember him. I remember that voice, and I remember his presence.
Now, did you guys have matching outfits? What was the attire for Boomers Jackson band?
Well, usually we started out with some kind of jacket, which you could probably call a Boomers Jackson jacket. It was more or less like something that you might find somebody wearing. You know, because it would usually be some sort of a plaid jacket. And we also went by the nomer of the Boomers Jackson and the Buffalo Bearcats. That was the actual name of the group. So we would have these astonishing jackets on, you know, which we would whip out. But that sort of changed. We wind up getting some very... When we got into New York, there was a place that I had remembered, the haberdashery that made clothes for show people, you know. And they would whip up, the next thing I know, we had these, we were wearing suits. And that gave us a sort of a fashion age. And so we actually dropped the Boomers jackets, and that worked out much better.
When the Boomers Jackson Band played in Philly, what was the venue?
Our usual stop would be the Earl Theater, which was probably an old theater that existed from the last century. It was a great show house, and I think it was eventually closed. But for years, it was the centerpiece of all the bands like Benny Goodman and Duke Ellington and Count Basie. So we would play there. We usually did a week in the theater. But then after that closed, the center became the a place called the Uptown Theater, and that was on Broad Street in upper North Philadelphia. It probably wasn't as large as the Earl, but it eventually became passé, as most of these theaters here did, because of the bands going into the stadiums, you know.
I kind of looked through some records, and it looks like, according to what I could find, you guys did a recording session in Cincinnati in 51 with Boomers Jackson. And one of the songs was I'll Be Home for Christmas. I don't know if you have any memories of recording in Cincinnati.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, that was a great tune.
Well, do you have much memories of the recording session? Was that the first time you'd done recording?
To my way of thinking, it was probably the first and the last. Every time they got a tune together for him to record, he would just go into the studio and record it, and then it would be released, and then we'd add it into the book, you know. So we very seldom, the band, as I recall, very seldom went into the studio to record with him. All they were interested in was recording the lyric and getting that part. They weren't interested in much else.
Did you ever meet Sid Nathan, the guy who owned King Records? Did you ever meet him?
I don't think so. I remember a young fellow who was the, what you might call A&R man. I think his name was Henry something.
Henry Glover?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember when you met him or anything, or anything about Henry Glover?
Oh, yeah, at the King Studios in Cincinnati.
Was he overseeing your session that you did with Bull Moose?
Yeah, yeah. I do know that that was the only occasion. I don't recall going over there on a regular basis. Maybe two or three times at the most.
Yeah, I find the session that you guys did that has you listed playing all your bandmates. I'll Be Home for Christmas. I Had a Hard Way to Go. I Never Loved Anyone But You.
Yeah.
Do you remember how things stopped with that band lineup with Bull Moose Jackson?
Well, I think it was a case of bad news and also people moving on. I think that something took place and several members were incarcerated and people were on the move back in those days, I guess. As the season ended, it all ended and Tad Dameron was without a band. There was no band. And I don't think he went back with Bull Moose. And I did get a call from Bull Moose a few times and at that time, he had John Coltrane was working with him. And that was a pleasure. You know, even though John was from Philadelphia, that was the first time I really had a chance to hear what a tremendous player he was. And was in that band with Bull Moose's last band that I remember being in. And then after that, Bull Moose, I think, went, from what I heard anyway, that he went into catering business somewhere in the Washington, D.C. area.
Well, so you played another show with Boomers Jackson with John Coltrane playing with in the band?
Yes, yes. That's the last band I remember playing with before all the other members had gone. By that time, everybody had gone in different ways. Philly Joe, I think, had gone with Miles Davis. And Benny Golson had gone with Art Farmer and formed the Jazz Chat. And Snooky Hubbard went back to the business school that he had in New York City. So I guess at the end of an era rather than the beginning, it felt like the beginning because they were trying some new things, and I guess getting Vamoose out there was one of them. And that worked. But then, you know, other things came, I guess. Things were changing very fast and around us. And it almost seemed like it should have been a band that should have and could have made a hallmark if there had been a more receptive environment for that particular venue. Because the fact that so many people thought it was a rhythm and blues band, when in fact it wasn't. I mean, we were playing the music of Tad Dameron, one of the greatest writers out of jazz, and Benny Golson, who was the youngest upcoming player. And that was what we were playing. I mean, we weren't playing any other kind of music. You know, we came along just for the hit of the Blue Note record.
I've never loved anyone but you. I'm thinking of fool to let you go. I used to do little mean things to you, but then I didn't know. I've never loved
You've been listening to a King Records special about Bull Moose Jackson. For more information on September's celebration of King Records in Cincinnati, please visit our website, WVXU.org. Technical support from Andy Balterman, Elaine Spears, and Michael Murphy. Next week, join us for a special about King Records recording artist Wynonie Harris. I'm Lee Hay.